we are here in the university club room at San Diego State University with the Honorable Leon Williams, who will be giving us a brief oral history of his experiences in San Diego for our program Creating Community, the African American Experience in San Diego. My name is Gloria Rhodes. I'm the Outreach Librarian at San Diego State. Today is October the 28th, 2008. Good afternoon, Mr. Williams. It's
Good
a pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure being here.
What I'd like you to
I'd like you to know my beautiful wife over here, too.
And hello, Mrs. Williams. Mrs. Margaret Williams is with us as well. And we are delighted to be able to record lived history of two of the most outstanding African American citizens here in the beautiful city of San Diego.
Sweet. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. What I'd like for you to do first, Mr. Williams, is to tell us a little bit about your childhood days. And then we're going to fast forward to your experiences here at San Diego State University, which was then San Diego State College or San Diego?
It was San Diego State College when I was here.
San Diego State College. But I think your childhood experiences have paved the way for your experiences here at San Diego State.
Well, that's long. I could take all day doing that, but I guess the essential part of what might be important would be I was born in Oklahoma, and I lived there until I was 14 years old. And I guess perhaps the most important part about that time of my life is that, because I was the oldest of a large family, and stock market crash of 1929 kind of turned things around in Oklahoma, and my parents were kind of knocked off their track in terms of their trajectory.
Okay.
And things were not so good there. But I guess what I remember most positively is that all the adults that I knew, and my dad's and my parents' friends and acquaintances, they were all, I guess what I would call, really solid people. They always did what they said they would do, at least as far as I could tell,
mm-hmm.
child.
Right.
And they were good-hearted. I never saw friction or mean-spiritedness among in those people. They were cooperative and helpful to each other, and so that's kind of what I remember mostly from there. I remember being very ambitious about getting further education. We lived not too far from the University of Langston.
Okay.
And so that was my fallback position. I thought, well, if all else fails, I can always go to the University of Langston.
Okay. And that's in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah, in Oklahoma.
Right.
Not very far from where we live. But we did move to Bakersfield in California. One of my dad's brothers lived there, and he kept telling my dad, they were close, you know, move to. And I was so anxious to move to California. Come on, let's go. So finally we did, and that was a great point for me. Now, I don't know if there's something else that you want to know. I don't want to make it too
now,
long, but if you
well,
have any questions.
So you're here in Bakersfield, California. Mm-hmm. So how and why San Diego State? How did you hear about San Diego State College?
Well, I really didn't. I didn't come here to go to San Diego State. My ambition had been to go to UCLA because those were the days of Jackie Robinson and Kenny Washington at UCLA, and you know, every day at high school the coach would you know tell us about all this dramatic, and that Bakersfield Californian would have these dramatic plays of Jackie Robinson running across the football field, and I said, that's my school. But then I was a pretty good student in high school. I mean, I was a darn good student in high school.
Okay.
When they gave us some kind of a test as graduating, upon graduation as seniors. And so before I could enter UCLA, mm-hmm. I got a job offer here in San Diego. And in those days, it was 1941, you know, I got a job offer for about $1 an hour, a job at North Island Naval Air Station.
Okay.
And right. I told my dad and everybody, well, gee, you know, that's pretty good. That's almost better than going to college right now. You're going to go to college later. So anyway, I came down here to do that. And I was going to night school when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and the Coastal War started. That changed everything.
Right. You were going to night school where?
At community college.
Oh, okay.
Well, then was called JC, junior college.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Okay.
So then I went off to the military. Mm-hmm. To Australia and New Guinea.
And what year was that? Do you remember the years?
1943.
Okay. And after you got back here to...
Got back here, I worked at North Island and went to some more school, and then I left and went to San Diego State full-time.
Okay.
For 2.5 years. And I got my BA degree, and I got admitted to...
What was your BA degree in?
Psychology.
Okay.
With a minor in English. And I was admitted to Claremont University for a PhD in psychology, but the Korean War broke out. So I decided not to go to work for my PhD.
And when you were here at San Diego College, San Diego State College, can you give us a glimpse of what life was like on campus at that
time? Well, in those days, you can imagine, there had not been, although I was a member of a group of people who, you know, even restaurants were not integrated in those days. There was a lot of racism in San Diego. And in order to break the segregated restaurants, we had, there was a group of people, two groups of people, one led by a fellow by the name of Manuel Talley, Fellowship for Reconciliation, and there's a doctor here in San Diego, dentist, Dr. Jack Kimbrough.
I've heard of him.
Yes, he's as a matter of fact, you got some of his records because he's a member of the Boulé, and
okay.
I was a member of the Boulé, and he was the first president of the Boulé organized in San Diego. But he had a group of people, and they were, like we would go mixed groups of white kids and Mexicans and black kids and Asians. We'd go to the restaurants, and they wouldn't serve us. But we just occupied the space, but it was not unlawful then. They couldn't, the law was on our side, but there was just a practice of Jim Crow in the restaurants. And so we would sit in restaurants and they would lose business. And, you know, eventually that was one of the things. That was a precursor, really, to the, I guess, the sit-ins and civil rights movement in the South that became dramatic. And I sat here wondering, one thing that got me into public service is that I wondered so much about how those kids could tolerate the hot cigarettes on their necks and their dogs and all that. And I thought, well, if they can do that, I can do what I do, what I had a chance to do later.
Okay.
Serving on the city council for virtually no pay.
So that's when it really, you really got that, I say, bug to make a difference, to make a change.
Well, I always had that. I think I always had that when, you know, as I mentioned, when in Oklahoma, we always had the desire to, to be part of the effort to make to create a better society. And so that just stayed with me all of my life. But the most motivating thing, I guess, was what was happening in the 50s and later in the 60s when the civil rights movement became, you know, intense.
And right. More of a national movement.
But we had, as I said, in San Diego, there's a group of people who were working a long time back in the 40s and 50s and in the 60s, too.
Okay. And what, after you finished San Diego State, well, let's go back to your experiences here at San Diego State. Were you involved in any, were there any organizations? Did they allow blacks to become a part of the campus, or how did you?
Well, no, for the most part, black students, and there were not very many, I think there were about 8 or 10 of us when I was here.
Eight or 10 blacks out of how many students?
Well, about 5,000 then. And there were Hispanics and Asians, but we couldn't. We were not allowed to participate in the student government, you know, much to the real activities. We were we were kind of on the fringe of campus life. I was a member of the psychology club, I believe, because I was a psychology major, and I was member of Toastmasters. That was, we kind of organized it ourselves. And there were a lot of white kids who participated with us, too. Mm-hmm. We had an organization called Intercultural Organization, which was made up of multi-ethnics. I was chair of that at one time. And we had a Spanish club, and I participated with the Spanish club, and a little occasionally with something called, I think it was Le Cercle Français. It's a French club. And sometimes we participated with them. But for the most part, we were outside of the student government.
So when you say participate, exactly what was the role?
We just had socials.
Oh, okay.
We had socials, or we'd have a, you know, get together, or, you know, things like that. And just kind of communicate and talk about things and, you know.
Right.
Student life.
Exactly.
And life in general.
Okay. So after your experience here at State, after graduation, what role did you?
I became a social worker because a psychology major. I had, as I said, I was going to...
Take a pause if you want to drink water.
No, I'm okay.
Okay.
I was a psychology major. One, after I didn't go, you know, I told you I was going to go to Claremont but after the Korean War came and I was working at North Island. I was back over there with a BA degree, but I was just going there for the semester because I graduated in February.
Oh, okay.
And so I was going to go in the following September, but the Korean War came in the meantime, and I said, well, I won't do that. And so I stayed in San Diego, and then I was hired as a social worker with the County Department of Social Services.
Okay.
And...
Were you the first African-American social worker?
Yeah, and
In the county? In the county?
Yeah.
Okay.
And... I became a supervisor within about 3 years, and then after I didn't go to Claremont I worked for a master's degree in public administration on this campus.
Oh, okay.
With Doctor's Kitchen, and there were not this current Doctor's Kitchen,
right.
But was a doctor by the name of professor by the name of Richard Bigger, and there was another one, I think. Two or three others. I worked for a master's degree, and so I got a job in the as a social worker. And then when I was working for this master's degree in public administration, then I was offered a job in the sheriff's department as administrative assistant to the sheriff in San Diego County, and. From there, I was...
How long did you work at the Sheriff's Department in administration?
9 years.
Okay.
What
were some of the things you were responsible for as an administrator?
Well, I did a lot of things in the Sheriff's Department. I created... at that time, we were... All the patrol cars were leaving from San Diego, city of downtown San Diego, driving out to the backcountry to patrol the backcountry. Which is, it's a big county, you know, 4,300 square miles. And so they were wasting a lot of time, and I established substations in the east and substation in the north. And they're, by the way, they're still there. They wow. became bigger and better.
Right.
And I put, we had deputies, you know, in those days we had our deputy sheriffs in the record, you know, keeping records.
Okay.
And I established records clerks, and I established court clerks, and established bailiffs. And instead of just using regular deputies, we had special class. And, oh, a lot of things like that.
So you really shaped the organization from
well,
within.
I helped to change it substantially, and change the concept of what the sheriff should be doing, and you know, created a lot more efficiencies. And then I was offered a job as after the Civil Rights Act and the War on Poverty, what do they call that? The Economic Opportunity Act of 1964. Signed by President Johnson.
Right.
I was offered a job to direct a program under the Urban League's control called the Neighborhood Youth Corps. And that was in 1965, and I think I started January 1966 as director of that program. And that was pretty active in the community in those days, you know. There were a lot of things going on with that Economic Opportunity Act. Hispanics and blacks were beginning to feel that we could be part of the society. Mm-hmm. It was always before that, there was a thing that the government was all by and for, quote, the man. And it was
right.
always that notion of the man controlling everything and the blacks and the Hispanics.
Meaning the white man.
And and the system, the establishment, those were the things
right.
that we had to struggle to open up and to create a space for ourselves in. And that meant not only organizing, you know, ourselves, but addressing what we call the establishment in such a way that, you know, we could be heard and become part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, there was a lot of talk on the part of members of the city council and, you know, and other people. What do those people want? What do they want? What do they want down there and over there? You know,
right.
it was well. It was a matter of we want the same thing anybody else wants. You want mm-hmm. a good education. Want to take care of your children. Want health care. Want a good house and a good job and so forth.
You sounded like a presidential candidate now.
Yeah, but those are the things that we were talking about.
Right.
And anyway, I should tell you something else though, before that. For graduate school, I applied for, because I had a psychology major, I applied to both the city and the county's Department of Personnel, you know, to be a personnel technician.
Right.
Right? So guess what happened? The city personnel department said, I got to have one of the highest grades, you know, on the mm-hmm. test. I wouldn't fit in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, on the city personnel department. County personnel department, wouldn't fit in. Same thing.
That yeah. is to be, I guess, that was the norm.
That was the norm.
Back in the day.
You didn't fit in. And but anyway, on the civil rights thing, we were pretty active with people like Tom Johnson, who's now deceased, and John Johnson, and Carol Wayman, who was an adjunct professor here at
yes,
one time.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
there were a number of others of us who were and there were a lot of Hispanics too whose names you would recognize, and we were all kind of addressing the system. And
and this was in like the 60s?
That was in the 60s. And then about 68, I think there were some, several vacancies occurred on the city council. And I had been then, I was pretty familiar because we called city community dialogues.
Right.
And there were a group of us who would meet with the city council members and the mayor and the city attorney and other city officials, and we met in City Hall. I've forgotten now how often it was, but we had a regular thing going. So I got to know the council members and the mayor pretty well. And in 68, when there was a lot of upset going on, you know, after Martin King got killed and
right.
And Bob Kennedy got killed.
Okay.
There was some real upsets, and I was at that time I was acting director of the Urban League, and so there was a group of people. There was a they called it, I've forgotten now. It was a
Bomb.
Yeah, it's called Bomb. They called themselves Bomb.
Okay.
It was called Black Oriental Mexican Brothers. Was what they called.
Oh, okay.
There was a group, and they had a conference, a nominating conference. There was a vacancy on the city council. They had a nominating, and in those days, the council could appoint. They didn't have to have a special election. The council could appoint for a vacancy, or select. The council would vote and appoint and select somebody. Anyway, this group, Baum, had this conference, and they nominated me to the city council for selection to be a member of the city council, and that was in 1968, and I was interviewed by the council in November something of 1968.
Okay, you were interviewed?
Yeah, I was interviewed by them along with many, many other people, but the so they selected me, and I was sworn in January of 69.
Okay.
Sworn in as a member of the council at 4th District.
You were the first?
I was,
first African-American city council.
Right.
Well, it was black back in the day, right? Or Negro. Black.
Well, they said black and Negro
okay.
and all that. And, you know, those were... But black, we considered okay. You know, we considered black to be okay. But Negro was kind of a put down.
Okay, all right.
But
so the accepted term was black.
Black. Council. That was preferable among black folks in those days.
Okay.
And so I was sworn in, and when I was sworn in to the city council, there was the council had. One staffer. I had one half of a clerk. That's all. One half of a clerk.
To work with you.
To keep my records and to do everything. To do whatever.
So you had a clerk part-time. A half-time clerk.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. I had one of my first fights was to was to get some staff.
Okay.
And I was a friend with the city manager then, Kim Moore, an assistant city manager, and he lent me a couple of staff members. There was an assembly member by the name of Mervyn Diamond. You know Mervyn Diamond. He's an assembly member right now. No,
what's
he was a state senator. He was a state senator. Mervyn Diamond. He arranged. In L.A., he was in L.A., but he arranged to for me to have a couple of staff members who were in a foundation that he had. So they came down here and helped me a little bit. But the real problem, the real issue was that I had a district. In those days, the districts were composed on the basis of registered voters, not population.
Okay.
That was a city charter provision. So I had, because I had what was then called Southeast San Diego, and it was included all the way down to the Mexican border, what is San Ysidro, that whole area was part of the 4th District. And so I had well over 100,000 people in my district, and other members had 65 or 70,000 members, and then my district was the greatest problem because these were the blacks and the Hispanics, and they wanted a role, they wanted to be responded to. So their attitude was, you're down there, man. You take care of it.
Okay.
And the other members of the city council were all white, and things were okay with them because, you know, it's okay. So they said, well, no, we got that unrest over there, Leon, so you're here now. You take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that was part of my dilemma. How am I going to take care of all this stuff? And the council, I had to keep my job as a you know, as a director of the Neighborhood Youth Corps. And that was okay. That was cleared up with the city attorney and the federal the attorney general. That they cleared up that was conflict was, well, no, was not an issue.
Okay.
So I kept that job for a while, and so I had the job over there, full time job, and I had a full time job in the council. And the council pay was $5,000 in those days.
Per year.
Per year.
Okay.
but it was a 12 or 14 or 15 hour job, especially for me because I had all these problems way down in the South, and I had all these people who were, you know, they wanted to be, they wanted something, you know, wanted the government to recognize them. And so I used to have meetings over in the community, you know, in people's houses and try to encourage people to participate, you know, community people in my district. And they would say, well, I got to work, you know, and the problem was, how do you take some time off? And I said, well, you know, if you don't come down and help to defend your area when somebody, an absentee landlord wants to convert that corner lot to a service station,
right?
Gets a conditional use permit to change that to a service station, and your house is across the street, what do you do? You know, mm-hmm. Can you take some time off to protect your house?
That's right.
Those were arguments I had to make in mm-hmm. the community to get people to participate. But it was also a problem of participating, of being listened to, because in those days, other members of the council didn't have much respect for black people and their I'm just telling you the way it was.
Right.
The respect level was pretty low for blacks and Hispanics. So they had came down to address the council about an issue. It wasn't taken nearly so well by most of the council members. I had to really be...
So you had to really be the voice of the community.
And I had to be a tremendous... I had to have tremendous persuasive power, because one vote didn't mean anything, you know.
That's right.
If they weren't convinced... Well, they just do whatever they want to do, and so
what were some of the major? I mean, I know it was a hard time, but with your leadership, what were some of the significant accomplishments that you could look back and say, you know, as a result of me taking the voice of the community to the city council, this changed, or we increased this amount,
well,
this was built, or this this organization was formed?
Well, one thing that I think is, I'm most pleased about was, you know, downtown San Diego was all dead, and the whole notion of all development was to be north of I-8.
Okay.
As it, you know, that's where most of the value went was going, and my district was downtown that day too. I had downtown as well as all the southeast and all that. So I used to look down on downtown from my office, and I said, it's so bad and so ugly, and nobody wanted to be there. And all. So I came up with the idea of and a fellow. I had a few friends, white friends, mm-hmm. like George Scott, who was a merchant in San Diego, had a store.
Walker Scott store.
And a few other people were like Hamilton Marston, who now, they're both deceased now, but he had Marston's department store.
Okay.
That was one of the high-class stores. They were friends of mine. And then the League of Women Voters, they kind of came to my...
League of Women Voters?
Mm-hmm.
So they were part of... Okay.
Yeah. Well, downtown was dead and was dying more. Everybody moved out. The Union Tribune moved down. I was a lone vote against the Union Tribune's conditional use permit in Mission Valley because I wanted them to stay downtown. And the Veterans Administration moved from downtown. Everything was dead. And so I wanted to keep downtown alive. So we created the concept of, well, first we had redevelopment, this this, all the city council members adopted something to improve the Horton Plaza, and that was kind of the old configuration of Horton Plaza.
Okay.
But we then...
So not the Horton Plaza as we see it today.
No, not as we see it now. But then after a lot of those people left, we had a new city council, and Pete Wilson came, and we created Center City Development Corporation, and George Scott and Hamilton Marston helped me to persuade the other members to vote for the Center City Development Corporation, which really created what you see downtown now, because downtown was absolutely a place you didn't want to be. You didn't want to be there. And even in the broad daylight, there was nothing there. There were peak shows and stuff like that.
Right.
It was ugly and run down and nothing. So that's one of my... That's number one.
So the city...
Center City Development.
The purpose was to wipe out the blight of downtown.
Well, to rebuild downtown and create an interesting place. And then after we did that...
Very good job.
Yeah, they've done, I think, a very good job considering there were things that could be done better, could have been done better, but it was 49,000 times better than it would have been. And then after that, we created SEDC, East Development Corporation, to move some of the development out in the eastern area.
Okay. And the population of... For that area, of course, was Hispanic and Black
Hispanic
at that time
and Black,
as well.
Okay, pretty much at that time, and the reason is because, of course, if you take the, as I said, you're struggling against that whole pattern of the movement, but somewhere else, and all the goodies would be somewhere else. And in those days, segregation hadn't gone entirely, and restrictive covenants. Had been ruling constitutional in the 50s, but other devices were used to keep people from moving. And of course, you couldn't expect the average person who, you know, had just a working job to buy a new house out in the suburbs somewhere.
Right.
You know, and then if they did that, what's the city going to do with all this land over here that's run down? So my focus was on, with the city, largely on trying to retain and maintain what we have.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, Balboa Park, all the buildings in Balboa Park were being abandoned, and my thrust was to recreate that. And
What buildings were in Balboa Park at that time?
Well,
I mean, like the museums and everything now?
Museums and the other buildings like the Prado, all those buildings along the Prado, and the Oregon Pavilion, that was falling off, the Cabasso was falling off the Oregon Pavilion. They were going to tear down the Ford Building and all that stuff.
Oh.
And so I was just very much against all that. I said, we need to maintain and keep, you know, these things. And so those, I inspired, at least I believe, that I inspired the city council and the city staff and the community people, because people like, as I said, George Scott, Hampton Marston, and there was a woman, I can't remember her name now, she became very active in Balboa Park. They created the Committee of 100, and they started doing a lot of things there. So a lot of those kinds of things, southeast area, had a lot of unpaved streets, and got a lot of streets paved, and senior citizen centers and
how long were you on the? How long 14 were you? 14
years.
Oh, wow.
And so we got parks.
So there were no such things as term limits.
No, there were no term limits then. No, no. If there had been, things would have been very different.
Right. You've done a lot, or you did a lot in that time frame. Absolutely.
And I don't know. There's so many things like that. Unless you have something specific, I can't.
What was let's look at the community in terms of the schools, the education. What was that like for not only the college student, but the elementary, junior high, high school student? Was there anything to do? Were the schools, what were the conditions of the schools?
There were a lot of problems with the schools, like Lincoln, for example, and Morris. there were student uprisings and student, and I would often find myself in that situation. Once,
what were the uprising? What were the issues that were related to what students walking out of school and things?
Yeah, and they were dissatisfied with the way with the way things were, not being fully recognized and being upset about what was happening in the South. And
right. Were they getting the secondhand textbooks and things of that sort as well?
They were getting secondhand textbooks, and the grounds were not maintained, and there were a lot of things like that. But one thing I did was arrange with the school district to close. At Lincoln High School, 49th Street was a through street through the campus, and I arranged a trade so that Lincoln High School could be created one pad of land, so the school had land on the north side of Imperial Avenue.
Okay.
The city had land on the south side over there, so we traded that land so that the school could be on that side and on the south side of Imperial Avenue. All that land over there was. And 49th Street was closed, and so it became a much bigger pad. And
what were the I'm going to ask something. It's probably going to be crazy. The schools were segregated?
No, they were integrated. They were integrated, but they were just where most of the blacks and kids went. Facilities weren't as good.
Okay. Actually, sort of subpar.
Yeah, it was so poor. And I guess some of that still goes on, but the best teachers would always, they could migrate. They had those agreements mm-hmm. that they could, move where they wanted to. So younger teachers would be here, or the less competent teachers would be where the black kids were, or mm-hmm. Hispanic kids. And I think that's still going on to some extent at least, but that was mm-hmm. a real serious problem in those days. And,
and
we didn't have we had some black teachers. By the way, when I graduated from San Diego State, I couldn't get a job. There were no black teachers then in the school system, so that was not a possibility. But later, as a community person, I worked hard with some of this, especially was a superintendent by the name of Will Crawford, and I've forgotten the name of the followed. They had the notion that black people couldn't be school principal. Mm-hmm. And I was very involved in getting the first black principal.
Who was the first black principal?
Ernie Hartzog.
Ernie who?
Hartzog.
Okay.
And he was, Rob mentioned that Carlin case.
Right.
Exactly. Ernie was part of that Carlin case. It was a fellow by the name of Larry Carlin, and I knew them very well. Mm-hmm. That Carlin case. But Ernie, after he was principal of Lincoln, moved to Portland, Oregon. But he was the first black principal we had in the school system.
Was he a native of San Diego?
No, he was not. I think he had come from Pennsylvania, if I remember correctly. But he was, I knew him very well because he had been part of the my neighborhood youth corps program. I was director of the neighborhood youth corps, as I told you.
Right.
And he had been one of the people I worked with in the school system because that neighborhood youth corps program was aimed at giving young people a job where they could get training, on-the-job training. And that was one of the things I did there in the 60s before becoming a council member.